Today, the vision thing. How to reconstruct our banking system and make Australia great again. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. And today I'm joined by Robbie Barwick from the CC. Hello, Robbie.
Hello, Martin. How are we?
I'm very good. Good to see you again. Thanks for spending some time with us. So I guess in reaction to the Royal Commission draft report that came out last Friday and that little line towards the end in Section 10, are structural options to be considered? It seemed timely to perhaps have a conversation about what we should do to fix our banking system.
Yeah, well, no, that's right. The Royal Commission has opened up a can of worms here on the banks, and we need to take full advantage of this. What we've done is, in our latest publication, the Australian Alert Service, we've put forward a five-point program that Australia needs to look at, which is premised on accepting the reality that we're heading for a crisis. And that's a big part of it. So the Royal Commission is dealing with the obvious problems in the banking system in terms of a lot of criminality, etc. This is related to that, but it's much more fundamental. It's not within the Royal Commission's remit, this particular question. But the solutions are certainly, we think the solution one is the solution of both. But first of all, you've got to accept the reality that we're heading into a crisis, right? If you don't, then if you want to be in denial, then you're going to ignore the problem until it's too late. Now, this is, you've been stirring the pot.
Just a bit.
getting lots and lots of reactions, but the content on your show lately has been stunning. Edwin, the interview with Edwin L. Mider, you cannot look at the property market in Australia and say we don't have a problem. And if what we've said for a long time, Martin, is given how significant the property market is for the banking system, the banks have put all their eggs in the property market basket. We cannot see a possibility of a housing crash in Australia that is not also a banking crash, right? Yep. They are way too overexposed this. And if it is, that's going to be just like Ireland, like the United States, etc. So we need to be looking at what do we have to do to restructure our banks and other measures, because we call for a number of measures, five in particular, that can, in anticipation of that, that can save Australia.
And it's worth, I think, before we get into your five, just let's just go through why this is so critical from a banking perspective. So we've got 65% of all lending in the banking system aligned to property. That's either investment property or owner-occupied property. And we also have additional lending to the construction sector as well. So massive leverage into that sector. The second is that every loan that's written already by the banks has a property value attached to it when it was written out, right?
Yes.
When it was taken out. But if that value is starting to fall, then effectively the value within the bank's systems and processes at one level won't change, but the risk profile will change. And at some point, they're going to have to revalue those portfolios.
Or if I can just interrupt there, this is what was the issue in 2007 and 8 when the slide in the US market was going on. This term came up, mark to market. You know, the banks are saying we're fine, but others were saying, well, if they mark their assets to the current market price, they wouldn't be fine. And any analysis of what happened in 2008 worth its salt knows that ultimately for the banks, the risk they were willing to take in properties was premised on the assumption they'd keep going up. That was their ultimate backstop. And when that stops, and that's the situation in Australia now, when that stops, they stop going up and they start to slide, that changes the calculations for everything.
Absolutely, it does. And the point there is they've got a loan, and the loan is actually in the bank's books, as it were, at a particular point in time. But behind it is the security of the property. And there are some assumptions in their risk models, particularly those with internal risk models, relating to the risk of loss and relating to the value of the underlying asset. So if the underlying asset starts to change and reduce, the risk profile goes up, that puts a whole bunch of additional issues in terms of how they actually account for that, right? So this is a big deal. And people, that, you're right, the mark-to-market question has hardly come up yet in Australia, but it will, definitely will, as prices fall further. And we know that in some places, in some postcodes, properties are down now 22% in a year.
Yeah, and by the way, the 65% you mentioned, that is, no other banks in the world come close to that level and have come close to that level. I mean, I think at the moment, mortgage lending in the United Kingdom is about 20%. In America, it's around 30%. In America, it got maybe went over a bit over 40% at its height. What we have done in Australia is just unheard of around the world. And that's the other reason we're saying, especially the big four, how can they survive what might, you know, if it's already 22% falls in some cases, and then the implications of that start coming onto their books, how can they survive that? One of the things we're calling for, we think people should be done, Martin, is an independent audit of the big four banks and an independent audit. And that means not the big four auditing companies, right? They're those companies
who are hardly independent, right?
Exactly, and have zero credibility in my view, like the ratings agencies. They've all been part of the problem. If some government appointed auditor went through those banks with a fine tooth comb, what would they find? People assume APRA does this stuff, and it doesn't, right? I have firsthand knowledge of that. They do this, the kind of thing where, if I could indulge you for a second, just recently, because I like to get my kids to watch old classic movies sometimes to balance Disneyland movies, I got them to watch It's a Wonderful Life, which is this black and white Frank Capra classic. And there's a funny fight there between the local bank who's there to look after the local community and this big evil bank owned by this guy, big evil guy Potter. But in the story, there's this ever-present figure of the bank examiner who comes in and he terrifies everybody because he comes in and he demands to see the books and he goes over with a fine-tooth comb, and if they're not, if they can't show there and then that they have the money to match their books, they're gone. Right, and it's just such a cultural difference to today, because there's no equivalent today looking over the bank's shoulders and saying, "Is this real? Is this real? Is this real?" And if we did an audit of the Australian banks, I think you'll find a total disaster in there.
Mm. Yeah, self-regulation is pretty much what there is. You know, there's a little bit of oversight, but it's very marginal, and as we've seen, it was completely captured. And just sort of round out, so two other points. The bank funding question, of course, the international funding markets are already going up. We saw that overnight with the bond yields going up. Their point there is that the international funding is in question, and if the international markets essentially freeze, then they have a liquidity crisis. Sure. So that's important.
That was very dramatic last night, especially when you consider it. That's not a central bank raising rates. That's the market pushing rates up.
Yep. Yep.
And, you know, what is it, 40% or something of our bank's borrowing is from overseas. Our Reserve Bank has no control over that kind of interest rate flowing through to the borrowers here.
Yeah. And they, of course, are reliant on that funding. It's not a one-off thing. So effectively, they are continually refreshing their funding because they've got a lot of short-term borrowing to fund their book. So as those rates go up, effectively the funding pressure continues to rise. So it's a continual process. So pretty much you can say that on every front there are questions. And the fifth one, of course, is that they have been reliant on mortgage growth to drive their profitability. And if that mortgage growth, the growth in credit, actually stops, then their profitability is already shot to pieces. So even without any fall in the level of credit, in other words, if it just goes at the current level, that isn't going to be enough to continue to drive their profit up. So effectively, they are now in profit concerning territory before all the rest of these things. So whichever way you look at it, the banking sector is in for a very bumpy ride. And now let's go then to you've got some ideas about what are the levers that need to be pulled now, because, you know, wake up, everybody's got to understand that we've got this issue now. This isn't something which may happen. the seeds are already laid, and so now it's time to cut the dovel of the past and try and deal with some of the issues that we actually have. So you've got a recipe. So what's your recipe?
Well, just before I get into the specifics, you had a conversation a week or two ago with John Adams about the hypothetical phone call that could collapse prices, house prices by 80%, based on the Irish experience. And in a sense, the choice there was between almost equally bad options, bailing out the international financiers or taking a depression, right? And what we think is that, of course, we shouldn't have to bail out. Like has been the international story of the 2008 crash onwards has been, terrible austerity inflicted on whole populations like Greece and other places in Europe to effectively prop up an international financial system. And that is, in our view, unconscionable. You don't want to get into that binary choice. You need to be able to take a sovereign approach where, at a certain point, we have to make up for the 40 years of neoliberalism, laissez-faire type of philosophy. We have to recognize that what's been allowed to happen in the name of financial innovation has been a disaster, in fact, right? All these products, so-called wonderful products that have made the financial system a lot of money, but they've brought us to this position. And sometimes there are times when I believe the government should always have a role in the economy, but there are certainly times in crisis when the government is completely justified in stepping in and say, for the sake of the common good, the following actions have to be taken. We draw a lot of inspiration and knowledge from what happened in the United States under Franklin Roosevelt, because that was such a time where you can see the results that there's a really good video you can see at the moment, which is a couple of days ago in Washington at the National Press Club. There was an event featuring about five experts discussing the 10th anniversary of the global financial crisis. And one of them, Robert Kuttner, he pointed out, look, imagine this was 10 years after the 1929 crash. What could you point to had been done? And a lot had been done, right? In those 10 years after 29, not for the first few years, but once Roosevelt came in, there was a huge reform of the financial system that made it function much. He made the point, it made it function like a utility, right? Mm-hmm. And it worked, and it kept the system stable and serve the real economy for the next, half a century more, actually, right? So we need to, we draw inspiration from that period to say, okay, what do we have to look at staring in the face of the same type of crisis now and potentially even worse crisis because of what computerization has allowed in terms of the scale of speculation that is, unprecedented. So first and foremost, as we've discussed many times, our number one policy is Glass-Steagall. Right, you need to fundamentally change the structure of the banking system. So what Glass-Steagall does, it says, here's the real financial system that serves the real economy. It's what all of us use, right? We actually cannot do without it. There's too many of us to barter anymore. So, and therefore because we require it, unless we want to live like a hermit, we require it. It does have to function like a utility. Right, and therefore, let's make it work properly. And what the Glass-Steagall Act did in 1933 is take that and separate that away from. There's another side of the financial system, which has a role. Insurance has a role. There is even a form of there's a certain role for investment banking. I mean, if rich people have money, they want to invest, right? And they don't just want to park it in a bank and they want to do things with it. Well, that's what investment banks are supposed to do. So they can do that. But that cannot be ever something that the rest of the economy is at the mercy of, right? If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. There's a certain element, and if you took that away, if you separated them out, a lot of the worst excesses in the financial system would vanish pretty quickly because there's an implicit guarantee from the real financial system for those activities. right? So,
and so just to be clear on that, what we're saying is that things like lending and deposit taking and the payment system, you know, the things that supports the broader economy are things that should be there, but they shouldn't be contaminated and effectively at risk by the higher, more speculative, more risky things that are at the moment cross-wired into this basic part of the banking system.
That's right.
And so it's teasing it apart that's the critical point. Whereas, in fact, today, more and more of the profit of the banking system generally around the world is made from those speculative activities and taking bets on the future of particular, trades and those sorts of things, rather than actually the core banking.
And even normal core banking activities like mortgage lending, which is a normal core banking activity, has been contaminated by it, because the problem we have now is not just normal lending, it's the consequences of the securitization and the derivatives trading on that yep. allowed the banks to get normal mortgages off their books, lend more quickly, right? Start making a lot of money on the trading side of it, and they wanted to do even more lending, run out of people they could afford to pay them back properly, and so hook the books to be able to lend to people that couldn't afford it, because the risk of doing that was outweighed by the profit they're making on the other side. Right, and it's totally distorted the financial system, and we're dealing with the consequences of now with unaffordability of housing and all those types of things. So that's structural change. What Glass-Steagall does, it puts a real brake on that kind of speculation. The speculation cannot feed off the real financial system. It does not grow, and there's lots of figures that prove that.
A postscript which I have is, I think also that speculative banking, if it's allowed to continue, and there's probably a role for it, might want to attach a financial transaction tax also to those particular activities, right? Because effectively it's not productive for the broader economy at the moment. So there are techniques that can be used to effectively harness it, both in terms of separation, but also in terms of different tax structures.
Well, we've long proposed a 0.1% transaction tax on financial turnover. That's a dollar in a thousand. Mm-hmm. And if you buy and sell shares for your own investments, you could handle a dollar in a thousand, right? If you're a normal mum and dad investor, etc. If you're a high frequency trader operating, if you're the guy who operates high frequency trading machines for Morgan Stanley or something, right, and you actually have to pay a dollar in a thousand, as little as that is, on all those high frequency trades, you're not going to want to do it, right? You've got to put up real money for all those things that are happening in milliseconds. So yeah, that's the other thing you can do to make sure that you really tamp down on that kind of activity. Now, I just want to mention, so we in the CEC, we worked very hard this year. We drafted a bill for an Australian Glass-Steagall. We based it on the United States legislation. Both the original one and a bill that's currently before the US Senate that is, updated to reflect modern financial products like derivatives, et cetera. We also made it relevant to the Australian financial system, right? That bill's introduced in the Parliament now. It was introduced back in June by Bob Catter. So it's there, ready to go. The main part of our bill is the Glass-Steagall structural question and how to achieve that. There's a large section, though, on APRA, the bank regulator, effectively bringing that under control, much tighter control of the Parliament. One of the things that will do, which I want to mention in this context, is there in a crash, the way we're going at the moment, if there's a crisis, Australia's at very real risk of what they call bail-in, right, where savings will be grabbed of all types, including potentially deposits, that you cannot rule that out happening in Australia. Our bill... and those controls on APRA would be the best safeguard against that, because no truly representative parliament is going to want to get into something that's going to cause so much chaos to people. And if we can bring APRA under tighter control, we can make sure that part, those kind of the powers that APRA currently has that might be able to do that, don't get used.
We did a thing the other day with John Adams on the bail-in, and it was a bit of a long program. But we got a lot of reaction because people hadn't realised what happened earlier in the year and how ambiguous the current situation is. And this is a way, as you say, of effectively nailing it and basically taking that risk off the table. So it makes a lot of sense.
So the Royal Commission, as you said, has opened up the door on this question of structural change, structural separation. They've actually, there's quite a lot of questions pertaining to it in the various parts. The Royal Commission interim report, the Commissioner actually cites the Glass-Steagall Act as an example of how structural change, the way he, if I can read the quote here, he said the point of citing the Act in his report is that structural regulation of banking activities is not novel, right? So he wasn't saying that, but he was at pains to say, look, I'm not recommending this yet, like he's not recommending anything in the current report, but he actually cited that. So look, there's a precedent for this. And we say, yes, absolutely, Mr. Commissioner, we agree. Why pussyfoot around? Let's do it. And so people we've got a big campaign to push this hard. We're encouraging everyone to write submissions to the Royal Commission that on the interim report that closed by the 26th of October, just so that he gets a sense from the Australian public that the public want this. That he's going to be told by the banks not to do it, right? They're going to be lobbying like mad. He needs to see the other side of the public saying, no, let's do it.
Indeed. And it's worth reflecting, I think, that many would say that the GFC could not have happened if Glass-Steagall had been in place in the US.
Yeah, well, maybe you could put a link to this program I'm talking about that people can watch that for themselves. There's a law professor on there, Arthur Wilmarth. He absolutely proved that. There's no way that Glass-Steagall would have happened, that the global financial crisis would have happened if Glass-Steagall had still been in place. The unwatered down Glass-Steagall, there'd been a watering down process over quite a few years. If they hadn't have watered it down and then scrapped it, there's no way that you would have had the scale of speculation that led to that. And he really compared it to the same explosion of speculation that led to the 1929 Great Depression. It's worth people knowing that to be confident in seeing why Glass-Steagall would be such an important part of the solution now. Some of these bankers are pretty sly, and they try and make it out like, we've evolved so much in 80 years that those things don't apply anymore. We're so much more sophisticated now, right? And I just don't buy that. Those arguments for a second.
Okay, so Glass-Steagall, the separation of risky banking from meat and potato banking is your first platform. Okay, so what's the second one?
A national bank. That is a government-owned bank that's there. We have legislation that we're refining it, actually. We originally drafted legislation back in 1994 for a national bank called the Commonwealth National Credit Bank Act. But since then, there's been a lot of changes to the banking system in Australia, such as the Commonwealth Bank was privatised. You've got the Wallace Inquiry reforms, etc. So we're refining that now to address the current financial system. But the essence of it is, look, this goes to what I was mentioning before with this choice between, bailing out the creditors or a depression. You shouldn't bail out the creditors, but the government can't sit on its hands in a laissez-faire way and let a depression happen, right? It requires massive intervention at that point. And a big part of this is an understanding that, in a sense, the financial aspect of it all is secondary. Right? Financing is a tool. You need the tool, but don't think of it as more than that. The government needs to grab the tools of finance, and a national bank can provide those to make sure the real economy works, right? And there's so much that can be done, and it's not gimmicky. You're not talking about putting people into jobs just to keep them employed and painting rocks white, etc. It's not Keynesian, which is the idea of flooding liquidity into the system to increase consumer demand, right? And wherever that money turns up, it doesn't matter. No, you're talking about saying, there's so much the government can do to provide jobs that are needed. And a lot of that starts and finishes with infrastructure, right? 10 years ago, people we were working with, real experts, put a figure on Australia's infrastructure deficit of $700 billion, right? That's the figure they put on it 10 years ago. It'd be even more now. The kind of infrastructure we see always tends to be public-private partnerships, etc., where the point of the infrastructure is the money that can be made of it primarily, and the the road or the railway or the bridge is secondary, that the function of it. No, you've got to invert that. You can start investing in the real economy through the government. Can do that with a national bank, provide jobs straight away, start to reverse the financialization of the economy that's contributed so much to this, and start to reindustrialize the economy, right? It's talking about in some sense of the transition period, but you're talking about making sure that, unlike the Depression, when I've talked to old timers and there was, you know, there were shops full of food, but no one had money to buy it, right? Get people working so that that can actually, you know, the real economy can function properly.
Right. So the focus there is investing funds into real proper projects and infrastructure development and those sorts of things, rather than just ever more lending to inflate home prices to lift the mortgage book ever bigger, right? So it's a fundamentally different approach to banking and how banking should and could work.
Well, you look at the Commonwealth a couple of days ago, your old friend Stephen Kokoulis, retweeted a ComSec tweet, which was of a chart of Australian house prices since 70s or something, maybe earlier. And what it showed was the spike after 2000, a plateauing from 2005, slight up to sharp fall heading into 2008, and then an even sharper rise coming out of 2008. And see, that's where the government is, you know, conning us all, right? Because they did things like tripled the first homeowner's grant, encouraged the banks to put even more money into what was already then the danger of the economy, the housing bubble, to make it even bigger. Because on the back of that lending, that's new money being put into the economy. That's circulating around. That's giving us jobs, of course. Our biggest employer now is construction. Construction, financial services is the biggest sector of the economy. Construction is the second biggest sector of the economy. Right, I'm not going to say construction jobs aren't productive, but they're there because of the bubble, right? So that makes things look okay, but it's not actually fundamentally sustainable in terms of how an economy should work. We're completely dependent on whether we can sell resources to China or not in terms of our industrial wealth, and we've let things like the car industry disappear. Go the way of the dodo, right? And all those jobs, high-skilled, high-paid jobs, which give us a capacity beyond just making cars, goes with it. So, you know, it's inverting that. It's a very important opportunity for the government to really get in and say, okay, let's get the real economy going again here. You can do it. So infrastructure is a primary thing. Loans to industry, you know, manufacturing, agriculture is very important. Plus, the government will have to step in and sort out the banks. There's no doubt about that, right? And if it's got its own agency of a national bank behind it, then it has the capacity to do that much more effectively, right? It can provide that financial strength that it can then use to make sure that sort out the banks and those that can be saved, save them. Those that can't be saved, let them go. But the Commonwealth Bank, the new bank, can make sure the profits are guaranteed, right? And on it, actually pay those, not the profits, sorry, the deposits. It can guarantee the deposits. The original Commonwealth Bank, Australia's original national bank, did that in World War II and World War I. And in the period, it stood behind the banks, and the whole public knew that bank deposits in Australia were guaranteed because the Commonwealth Bank, anytime there was a crisis, said we stand behind the banks and deposits were guaranteed, right? So this is the kind of strength that the government can have with that, and it will need it in this kind of reorganisation.
And one other point I think worth making, and that is that if you think about our retail banking system at the moment, they actually make very high profits, and those profits flow back to investors, mostly overseas, some locally, right? But there is a 10 to 12% cost on Australia Inc., because of it, right? So if you have a banking system, you know, a publicly owned banking system that is there not to generate a massive return from the financial system itself, but to enable and facilitate the investment that we need, then effectively the broader economy wins.
That's right. That's what I say. With a national bank, the bank's not there to make a profit. It's there for to make sure the country makes a profit. Mm. Right. That's just that alone is a totally different philosophy in banking. I haven't done it for a couple of years, but it's instructive to add up total private bank profits in Australia since 1997, when the Commonwealth Bank, even at that point when it was only just a government-owned lender, nothing more spectacular than that, because we would give it a lot more power than that. But just the its existence as a government-owned lender up until 1997 made the private banks provide much more service to their customers, right? And you look at the explosion of private bank profits in Australia once it was privatized. They just went off the chart. We've become used to them now, but that's what happened when you got rid of the Commonwealth Bank as a public lender.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, so number two then is the public bank to drive effectively infrastructure investment and other things. Okay, what's your third strategy?
This is quite important. We want to get this into circulation now and people thinking about it because we are convinced that the crisis in Australia will centre around a crash of the housing bubble. What we do not want to see, I still can't get over the great injustice in America of the 2008 crisis, is that the banks that caused it were bailed out and allowed to keep their bonuses that year, while in the next 5 years, I think 5.5 million households representing over 12 million people were foreclosed on.
Yep.
Right? And of course, you can take the hard-nosed attitude, oh, yeah, it was their own fault. They couldn't, afford to, they shouldn't have borrowed in the first place. And a lot of that on paper is absolutely true. But as we know, and as Denise Braley has shown in Australia, it's not when UBS calls them liar loans in Australia, it's not the borrowers who've done the lying. A tiny fraction may have. It's the banks who've done the lying. And the borrowers cannot be left to carry the can here on their own. So what we're doing is calling for an immediate now. We're saying now the government should take stock of what's come out of the Royal Commission, et cetera, and now put a moratorium on all foreclosures of family farms and homes. There are people losing their homes now, and that's just going to get worse. There are family farm. Now, the family farm sort of causality is slightly different, except insofar as it's also driven by a fair amount of bank bastardry with the family farms. I think there's a whole other story we won't have time to go into now about how APRA's incentivization of the banks to invest in the housing market through things like allowing the banks to lower their risk weighting on mortgages to make mortgages far more profitable than any other loans, that's been an incentive for banks to be bastards to family farmers, right? Because if they withdraw credit from areas of agriculture, as they've done, there's been a wave of them around Australia in the last few years. That's just more money for them to lend into housing, right? And they've used the excuse, like with the Bank West borrowers, oh, yeah, no, we had to, these were loans at risk. We had, we've got to take these steps. And they're pretending they're prudent, but meanwhile, they're putting extra money into a housing bubble. There's nothing prudent about what they've been doing. The whole thing's a fraud. So you cannot let a laissez-faire philosophy govern this. Now, what we're not saying, it's not up to the government to get, a lot of people, there's a lot of ordinary people who were talked into being property investors, right? You can't save their investment properties. It's not up to the government to do that. A lot of them are going to lose those properties because, they're way too leveraged and they just can't afford it. But what you can do is make sure no one loses their family home, their abode, where they live. The government can put a moratorium on all those foreclosures so the banks don't get to effectively asset strip the public to save their own in an attempt to save their own hides. There's precedents for this. This is very important. And the fact that there are precedents for this shows you how far we've strayed philosophically in this neoliberal era of the last 40 years. In Australia, we had acts of parliament to stop home foreclosures during World War I. We had them to stop home in most states to stop home foreclosures during the Great Depression. The most effective one was Jack Lang's New South Wales Moratorium Act of 19 December 1930. That stopped all foreclosures until 1937. In the federal parliament, There was a paper read, if I can cite this, there was a paper read into Hansard on 15th of November 1935, and the language here is very striking, because it just, again, it just shows you that these people, and Conservative as well as Labor, supported this in 1935. What they said in when they were describing the moratorium legislation, they said it was not expedient in the national interest that the welfare and comfort of the community should be unnecessarily imperiled by allowing debtors to be crushed out of existence. Right? They recognised that's what is, was at risk here, and they made sure that didn't happen. In 1933, Franklin Roosevelt called for the same thing. He introduced a homeowners loan corporation, because actually the banks didn't want to play ball very much, so he set up a government agency to do the refinancing to allow people to stay in their homes. He called a national policy that the broad interests of the nation require that special safeguards should be thrown around home ownership as a guarantee of social and economic stability. And that's striking, because this whole bail-in thing, if I can go back to that, is justified in the name of financial stability. They've set up an edifice in the last decade following the global financial crisis. Around the world, they've set this up. Oh, well, we're going to have a system now. We can grab your deposits, because that we need to be able to have these extreme powers to guarantee financial stability. Well, our statesmen of yesteryear, they had more care about social and economic stability, right? And that's why you would implement a policy like this. Now, part of it, and you might have your own comment on this as we've discussed, but you're going to have to restructure the loans, right? The problem is, if people wake up one day and their property is worth, you know, is 40% down, as you think there's a 20% chance of, or worse, right? If it's 2004 levels again, et cetera, and they've still got current levels of debt on that property, right? That's just, you know, unbearable. You can't live through that. So this is where, as I mentioned before, with the National Bank, and when the government steps in to reorganize the banks and sort out the mess, it's going to have to restructure all their lending and their debts, and you're going to have to write down the values of what's left owing on these mortgages to reflect the realistic price of the houses, and the payments have to be restructured. That's the type of thing that you look at.
Yeah, no, indeed. And in fact, it's at the moment we're in the situation where if price falls continue and people have a mortgage this big, the price will go below and suddenly they're in negative equity, and then either the bank tries to foreclose, or if there are millions of loans and homes, they can't, because there's no, you know, what will you do if you foreclose on them? So you need a mechanism to be able to deal with this move down. And so what you do is you actually drop both the value of the property and the value of the loan, so that effectively both are manageable. And that's, by the way, the only way that I can see that we can get out of this over-leveraged household sector. You know, 190 is the latest number from the Reserve Bank in terms of debt to income, almost higher than anybody else around the world. Most households will never be able to pay off the debt they've currently got, right?
No, that's right.
So this is a way of effectively right-sizing the financial system, also protecting households through that process, and effectively making sure that they still got somewhere to live, but effectively we are actually able to manage the structure of the banking and the economics of the country through that. So this is something, and it has been done elsewhere, and the fact of the matter is that this is the only way that I can see that we're going to actually be able to find a way out of our current loan bubble that we're in.
No, because what the monetarists would say, they tend to think of this academically, as I debate with one of our mutual friends. monetarists would say that, you know, we can hack a depression, because at least what the silver lining for them is the debt goes, right? We do need to make sure the debt goes. There's no point propping the debt up, but you've got to do it in such a way that you don't unleash social catastrophe while it's happening, and that's when the government.
Yeah. And the point there is, if we're not careful, we will end up with a crash, and it will be disastrous. And you know, John Adams' vision of 80% down and stuff is certainly, you know, one that we should take seriously. But the point is, there are alternative levers that can be pulled if we actually approach it right now. So I think this is a very important conversation. And by the way, if you talk to Steve Keen, he'd say we need some sort of debt jubilee or some way to be able to actually deal with the debt that's in the system, because it's you can't digest it. It's too big.
Well, it's one of the reasons we also want the CEC, like we campaign for Glass-Steagall, not just in Australia, but around the world. Like these kind of measures, the best way, like, you know, they coordinated the response to the global financial crisis globally, but in a bad way. Let's do something coordinated in a good way. That's one of our points, actually, which we'll get to in a minute. So that you, if all countries do this, then we can be much better off on the other side of it.
Okay, so what's the next one?
All right, so we have specific, when I talk about the National Bank and the government can use it to build infrastructure, we have specific proposals for infrastructure, right? We're not just saying that in general, but, you know, we say let's build nation-building infrastructure and also science driver infrastructure. And that's a specific concept that we want people to understand. But nation-building infrastructure means don't just think about, you know, more roads and tunnels in Sydney and Melbourne, right? That's not nation-building infrastructure. That's playing catch-up to a distorted economy where financial services becomes the black hole, and everyone has that's the center of the economy, and everyone sort of lives off the crumbs of that. And naturally, that happens in the big major cities. You know, let's go back to an industrialized economy. Let's do the things that can get regional centers revived again. But you don't. There's a lot of gimmicky discussion about that. How did those regional centers get there in the first place? They naturally formed around industries. Australia took advantage of its industrial capacity, developed it, and you had regional centres. We don't have those industries anymore, and we're wondering what gimmick could we use to save the regional centre. We don't have a gimmick. Get the industry back. But a lot of the impetus will have to come from infrastructure. And so we've promoted, the CEC had the pleasure of working with the late Professor Lance Endersby, who was the professor of engineering at Monash University for many years. At the end of his career, and before that, he'd started off his career working on the Snow Mountain Scheme. He built hydroelectric dams in Southeast Asia for decades. He worked on Tassie's hydro scheme. And this guy was a real practical, hands-on engineer. And one of the reasons we met him is because he became more active later in life politically and vocal. From a personal feeling of dismay at where Australia was heading, because when he was a student studying engineering, he'd been able to work on the Snowy scheme, and there, you know, his life's work's right in front of him. He can put his skills to work straight away. When he was teaching engineering at the end of his career at Monash, all of his students were doing, you know, business as a secondary option because they had no real confidence of what their career would be like in engineering. So he spent his superannuation money going around Australia, scoping out projects that Australia should be looking at to develop ourselves nationally again, right? So he had one of his main ideas was for a Melbourne to Darwin fast freight train line. That's not Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane. That's Melbourne to Darwin up the guts, cutting through Shepparton, Dubbo, near Goondiwindi. That was it was to open up the inland, right? And that kind of infrastructure, what it does is it allows you to get produce that we can grow in Australia, and we're good at it, right? It allows you to get that to the big Asian markets very quickly. You can connect it to high-speed shipping in Darwin, and you can be in the biggest ports of the world within 48 hours, right? And so that capacity then allows you, you realize, well, we'll get wealth from that, but we can invest in better water infrastructure here, so we're not limited to the tyranny of distance crops that Australia has always been limited to, but you can have high-value horticultural crops justified by the fact you've got the market for them, etc. And that's how you transform a country. The infrastructure can make it happen if you've got the vision for it. Well, you can wait for a private consortium to sit on their pussyfoot around and come up with some kind of a scheme that involves whatever that term is for the value capture of the real estate along the route and all that rubbish. Or you can be a government that says, let's invest in this for the sake of the nation. We'll fund it with the National Bank. We'll encourage superannuation schemes to invest in the National Bank in bonds and whatever, and they can invest in it as well. You know, and you can transform Australia. So specific, that's what I mean by nation building. We're champions of the Bradfield scheme idea for far north Queensland, which that if that had been done, you wouldn't have the worst of this drought that's in Queensland at the moment. And there's a similar project, the Clarence River scheme in northern New South Wales, that could have alleviated a lot of the drought that we've got there now. So you can transform Australia if you with the agency of a national bank. And yeah, that's what nation building is. It's not just continuing to, you know, add band-aids to the already overcrowded cities, right? Secondly,
that just on that, it sounds then as though part of it is you have to have a bigger vision, a different vision to make this work, right? So that tells me that there's got to be a different political sense as well in terms of what's important and how priorities are actually determined.
Absolutely, there's a lot of lip service to it, but no, the politics is fully constrained. Now, there's two types of constraints, but people got to. Nowadays, when you talk about this, the right will tell you, oh, yeah, but the Greenies won't let it happen. And that's certainly a problem. You get a NIMBY stuff, you know, you get that kind of knee-jerk reaction to that. That has been a big problem. It didn't start there, though. This is the dirty secret. It started with neoliberalism, when suddenly it's about, you've got to have a business case for each project, et cetera. And these business cases were premised on, what does that project look like if it was a totally private project? Does it give you 12% return on investment and all this kind of stuff? And none of these infrastructure projects ever do. That's not the point of them. But when that kind of thinking came in, right, it killed everything. It just became a justification for we're not going to build anything anymore, right? Mm-hmm. But look now, you know, at we still live now on the vision of the men of yesteryear. The Snowy Mountains scheme, Tassie's Hydro scheme, these are two of the most brilliant engineering achievements in the world. The Sydney Harbour Bridge, the Bradfield scheme in North Queensland is named after the guy who built the Sydney Harbour Bridge, and he built it with eight lanes in 1932. They didn't need eight lanes in 1932, right? They were thinking about the future. Now, of course, there you see, you do need the eight lanes and more. That's why you got a tunnel. But, you know, we once had that. If we get rid of the ideology that's warped us in the last 40 years, right, I don't think it's that hard to go back to it, but people have to identify what the poisonous ideology has been. And that's we think, you know, we think we can capture this. It's still inspiring to a lot of people. Just on the science driver concept, though. See, what a science, the whole idea of a science driver is, it's like the Apollo space program in the United States, right, where you do something. I mean, what's the immortal words of Kennedy? We're doing this not because it's easy, but because it's hard. You push the boundaries of human capacity and you discover new sciences and technologies as you're doing it. And that helps transform the way society works. And that's what a science driver does. So Australia needs to be thinking about those types of things as well. CEC, we are very pro-nuclear. We have 30% of Australia's uranium, of the world's uranium in this country, right? But we don't, we have a knee-jerk opposition to it. So we let the whole rest of the world use it and we don't. And yet even now, when there's all kinds of concerns in the world about carbon, et cetera, which we don't necessarily buy into, but people do, that's fine. Well, there's an option there and they don't want to touch it. If we did develop it, like you could develop, there's so many benefits from that kind of, that's real high cutting edge science to do that. And that's the kind of thing we personally advocate as a science driver project, a nuclear power grid for Australia, where we develop and use our own nuclear power. Things like waste and safety are very much under control nowadays. People just need to read up on them. I won't go through those now, but we're very confident in those. Another science driver is a space program, right? Australia was the third country to launch a satellite into space from its own satellite into space from its own territory. That's what we had as a capacity. We were one of the world leaders in it. We are well positioned with our geography, places like Cape York, etc., could be. We didn't use that back then, but we could if we wanted to. We had other capabilities we used. Those are the things that we should be getting back, because you think, there's a small-minded view. How do you justify spending in those? What you've got to understand is the technological breakthroughs you make by doing that gets to be translated back into the economy, and that's for the benefit of everybody, right? So back to the Apollo idea again, I think it was, there's figures whether it's for every dollar invested, there was $14 in spin-offs into the American economy, some that kind of ratio. So that's what you look for there.
So we're talking the vision thing, aren't we?
Very much. No, very much. Yeah. Why should the vision thing be, why should a young couple wanting to start a family have as their sole preoccupation, can I ever possibly save up enough for a deposit to buy a home? Will I ever get into the home market? When they should be thinking, where could I live in Australia that my kids have the best chance to become something, some great scientist, explorer, whatever in the future? Mm. All right, let's go for that.
Yeah, no, that's good. Okay. So number five, one left then.
Number five, this is fundamental. I alluded to it before. International cooperation, right? No man is an island, and this country is an island, but the world's not that big anymore. The reason it's necessary is the crisis is global, right? So we should run our own show and do our own things in Australia that's good for us. But we want to have a relationship with the rest of the world. We want to have a good trading relationship. There's a lot we can offer them. There's a lot they can offer us. You don't want to do it. You got to get away. You know, there's a reason that the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, is on the nose around the world, though, because it's the epitome of this era we've lived in of multilateral trade agreements, which actually have not delivered us anything at all, right? So scrap all that. One of the things we have to do is recognize that you need international cooperation to address the banking crisis, because it's a global crisis. And so we propose, there was the Bretton Woods model. In 1944, the countries of the world got together at Bretton Woods and came to an agreement around a monetary system that served the world for the next 30 years. And it was undermined internally, but it could have still worked. It had fixed exchange rates. It had capital controls. It was based on the US dollar pegged to gold. There was a role for gold in the system. When you had the Bretton Woods system in place, Martin, you had a period of immense global productivity growth, right? That immediate post-war three decades was a period of immense productivity growth. And you didn't have the speculation that we have today. When they ended the Bretton Woods system, speculation went off the chart. So that one figure is, while it was in place, something like 97% of all foreign exchange transactions related to trade, right? Importers and exporters bought and sold currencies because that's what they need to do for their importing and exporting. Today, less than 1% of foreign exchange transactions relate to actual trade. The rest is just pure gambling, right? And those gamblers they can destroy whole economies overnight, like George Soros did to the Asian economies in 1997. The explosion of speculation started with the end of that. Let's convene. Australia should. There's a lot of calls for it around the world. Australia could help lead the call, and take the leadership in convening such a conference where we sit down and say, okay, what do we do? What agreements can we come up with where we have an international monetary architecture that works for everybody, every nation? All right. So that's one level of cooperation. The other one is on infrastructure as well. We, in the CEC, we promote the importance of Australia accepting China's invitation to join the Belt and Road Initiative. Now, this is very controversial. All I'd say is, so for those who straight away react to, because everything's been said about China at the moment, I want to say one thing. The main source of everything said about China at the moment is the same people that told us that we're going to have a new world order of regime change for bad regimes and usher in world peace. Tony Blair, all these neocons in America, and all they did was destroy the planet, right? I look at the last 20 years, and the worst problems in the world were caused by Western countries, in my view, in those kind of insane interventions in the Middle East, etc. China's not responsible for that. China's had to deal with its own problem, which is 1.4 billion people, and how does it have an economy that serves them, that works? And what it's done, by any measure, has worked. And in 2008, it had its own vulnerability, which was its dependence on American consumers, right? And it also took a turn after 2008, but a different turn to the rest of the world. It issued a lot of money, but that money, unlike quantitative easing of the West that went into propping up banks, China's credit that it issued through its big state-owned banks went into the biggest infrastructure program the world's ever seen. And it didn't just benefit China, it's being spread around the globe. American neocons are telling us that everywhere China is helping other countries invest, that's just China trying to buy influence because it wants to buy the world out from under America's feet and become the new power. You can look at it that way, or you can look at the actual results on the ground and see that there is a lot of benefit in Africa and Asia from these projects, and we would benefit from them as well. A few years ago, when Julia Gillard's government said that a Melbourne to Brisbane high-speed railway line would take, I think they said it would cost $108 billion and take 50 years to build, we put out a statement saying the government should invite China to come in and build it for us because, but the scale that China does stuff, this could be done in 2 or 3 years, you know. Now, we have a lot to, we're not, what's the Belt and Road idea? It's the idea of let's develop railway infrastructure, port infrastructure, shipping infrastructure to make trade, to expedite trade between us, right? We are a high-skilled economy. We're losing it, but, you know, we have that legacy. We can contribute a lot in terms of skills. We would get skills back from that process. And as I said, it would complement some of those other projects I mentioned earlier, such as the Melbourne to Darwin fast freight line, where we can get our stuff into Asia, etc. That's the basis upon which you can have peace between countries, where you cooperate around economic development that's beneficial to both of you. If peace is just based on a treaty, right, it's not as sustainable. Based peace around, you know, if we don't want war with countries like China, and we certainly don't, we're not going to let it, you know, we don't want idiots in America to talk us into one either, right? Let's actually see the good. Don't knee-jerk reaction to everything. See the good and join it, right? There's a lot there that's actually good and it's worth joining. That's our view.
So it's been a very, very interesting and wide-ranging discussion, Robbie. And I guess the conclusion is that there are levers that can be pulled. You know, people might not agree with all of them and, you know, there will be different points of view. But the point is we need some different thinking and we need some different approaches to those that are actually trotted out every day in Canberra, because clearly they're not actually serving the country very well, and certainly the people in the country very well. So I think that's a very interesting set of observations, and I'll be interested to see what people think on the YouTube channel. You know, leave your comments and suggestions and observations. You probably won't agree with all of it, but that's okay. That's the whole point of this. It's about debate, and it's about understanding their alternatives and there are options. And I guess the final point is that at the end of the day, it's about people power, isn't it, Robbie? That there are people, you know, listening to this and listening to the other discussions going on. But do more than listen. Write to your MP, you know, get involved.
Absolutely.
Because the current mechanisms that exist inside the political dialogue just aren't getting us to where we need to get to.
Right now, they're in a lot of denial in the halls of power, and they need to be kicked out of that denial by their constituents. And that's where that writing letters, phone calls, emails to MPs is very valuable. And I've seen it. I know it works. And I particularly appeal to everyone, join the spearhead of our campaign for Glass-Steagall, this very fundamental banking separation. We've made a lot of progress this year, but what you can do in the next month is go to our website, look up the release we put out on the Royal Commission's call for submissions, and make one, right?
Yep.
You know, that will be noticed that if a lot of the public is saying, look, yes, we've got to do this, then the Royal Commissioner and politicians can weigh that up against the lobbying they'll be getting from banks, right? Because we cannot let, as I said in the statement we issued, we cannot let the banks dictate the policy response to the next crisis like they did to the last one. That's up to us, the people power.
Yep. And there is an opportunity, and there is a path that we can describe over the next month. You know, there is opportunities to put submissions in, write to your MPs and all those things too, because the more that they understand that there are voices out there who are actually saying there are alternative paths, the more chance we have of actually moving the dial towards where to where we want to get it to, rather than actually seeing the political machine and the economic machine effectively serve the few, and effectively the rest of the community is effectively cannon fodder, which seems to me to be the way it is at the moment.
Yep. We need a system for the many, not the few.
Yep, indeed. Robbie, I appreciate your time today. Thank you very much. It's been very interesting.
Thank you, Mark.
And appreciate your insights. And as I say, I will put some links below in terms of some of the things that you've been talking about, particularly that video, which I think is a really interesting one, talking about 2008. And to underscore it again, Glass-Steagall is really the linchpin point at the moment. That's where we can make the most difference the quickest.
Yep.
So encourage people to drive that. Thank you very much. We'll chat again, I'm sure.
Thanks, Martin.
Have a good day. Thank you. So there you have it. A really interesting discussion from Robbie there. You may not agree with all his points or indeed all his suggestions, but I think it shows that there is an opportunity for some different thinking to perhaps move us to a rather different place. If you like what you've seen here today, please like the post and add a comment or question. I read them all. And if you haven't subscribed already, please do subscribe to receive future updates. Don't forget, you can also support us via our Patreon program. The link is in the comments below. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll talk to you again next time.